You guys know I'm crazy about Audible because it offers an incredible selection of audiobooks across every genre. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, including the latest bestsellers and new releases. Audible really is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment, with female writers and heroines, celebrity narration, multicast productions with immersive sound design, and traditional audiobooks. Audible has you covered for any type of excitement that you're looking for. In fact, right now I'm listening to The Second Husband by Kate White. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/realitylife or text realitylife to 500-500. That's audible.com/realitylife or text realitylife to 500-500. With four daughters and two on a dance team, I can tell you we go through a lot of mascara in my house. But I'm crazy about L'Oreal Paris new Panorama Mascara, which catches every lash from corner to corner for maximum volume. If you're looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank, this is yours. The new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look in a premium gold luxe packaging. I've been using it for about 2 weeks now, and I feel like my eye has completely opened up, and the girls are crazy about it too. They've got a tapered brush to catch every lash, one of the best mascara wands that I've ever used. And like I said, this luxe appearance of this gold package, you got to get it. You can buy Panorama Mascara on Amazon today. L'Oreal Paris new Panorama Mascara, you're going to love it. Welcome back to another episode of Reality Life with Kate Casey. This episode is about Seduced, Inside the NXIVM Cult, which is a four-part documentary series on STARS, which follows the story of India Oxenberg's perilous journey through the dark and criminal world of the notorious self-help group turned sex slave cult, NXIVM. Keith Raniere was founder of NXIVM, which was a multi-level marketing company and cult based near Albany, New York. Between 1998 and 2020, NXIVM developed a following primarily through its personal development seminars, and it recruited celebrities, people in business, and even socialites. However, the organization also faced multiple accusations of systemic sexual abuse of female members by Raniere and members of his inner circle, leading to the arrests of Raniere and other NXIVM members in early 2018. On June 19, 2019, Raniere was convicted of federal crimes, including sex trafficking of children, conspiracy, and conspiracy to commit forced labor, all related to a secret society with the NXIVM known as DOS, or The Vow. On October 27, 2020, Raniere was sentenced to 120 years in prison. India Oxenberg was a member of DOS, serving as a second-line master. Her master was Allison Mack, an actress who rose the organization's ranks. She was arrested in Brooklyn by the FBI on April 20th, 2018, on charges of sex trafficking conspiracy, and forced labor conspiracy in relation to her role in the NXIVM organization. Allison Mack pled guilty to racketeering charges in April of 2019 and is currently awaiting sentencing. During Raniere's trial, the first witness was a 32-year-old woman identified only as Sylvie, and she had spent nearly 13 years in the organization. So to give you some sort of insight, Keith Raniere exerted control over his female followers on the most fundamental level. So women in NXIVM were encouraged to enroll in Jeunesse, which was this all-female organization within NXIVM. The point of Jeunesse, as Sylvie understood it, was for women to work out what they were. So outside of the influence of men, a mission predicated on Raniere's belief that women's actions were primarily intended to attract male attention. So Raniere also taught that women were prone to objectifying men in a certain way, meaning that women only assessed potential male partners based on whether they were good providers or caretakers. A common phrase in NXIVM was that women lived in a bubble, meaning women didn't have to be responsible for anything. We live in a fantasy land and everything gets taken care of. Well, the following year, Raniere taught a course led by Society of Protectors, which was the male equivalent of Jeunesse, so which Sylvie said cost anywhere between $5,000 and $8,000. So it had been presented, I think, in Jeunesse specifically, as she said, that women lacked character and that the SOP complete would teach us character. So in SOP Complete 1, women were taught, among other things, that they were inherently more impulsive than men, that the best way to curb their impulsivity would be to adhere to a strict diet. So Sylvie, who herself was in recovery from an eating disorder, testified that this aligned with her first impressions of the group's female members, who tended to be very, very thin and adhered to extremely low-calorie or restrictive diets, such as the Master Cleanse or a raw vegan diet. The course also relied on humiliating, gender-based exercises to encourage women to correct their behavior. So, for example, during one exercise, women were told they were showing too much cleavage and thus told to parade around like cows in a county fair and be awarded rosettes and prizes for their udders. After years of absorbing these teaches, it's no surprise that the women would be drawn to DOS, perhaps the most explicit way that the misogyny inherent in NXIVM was enacted. So what drew women to DOS was not the idea of becoming closer to Ranieri, an assistant U.S. attorney Tanya Hajar stated during her opening arguments, and as Sylvie's testimony later confirmed, many of the women recruited as slaves did not even know Ranieri was behind the group in the first place. They thought they were joining a women's-only group that was about helping other women, Hajar had said, adding that DOS was pitched as a women's empowerment group to make them happier, to make them stronger, and to make them more successful. So in forming DOS, Ranieri exploited his female followers' desire to empower themselves, to improve themselves, to be happier, better, more fulfilled, more, as he allegedly coached Sylvie, when encouraging her to take explicit photos of her vulva vulnerable. With this misogynistic teachings, Ranieri spent years grooming his female followers for subjugation to the point that many of them were persuaded to have his initials branded upon their very flesh on the grounds, their reasoning that it was more badass, which was their words, than a tattoo. And as the attorney said in the opening statement, seemingly just as befuddled by this perverse masquerade of self-empowerment as anyone else. Dr. John Jalalich, a sociologist who runs cultresearch.org and has written about getting out of cults, has said of the NXIVM inner workings and how Ranieri built a culture of misogyny and abuse. Using that kind of misogyny was a way to get the women to hate themselves in a way and behave in a subservient way, which is what Keith Ranieri was promoting. While the filmmakers, Cecilia Peck and Inbal Lesner, always saw Seduced as a women's story, particularly as it involved harrowing stories of sexual assault. It needed to be told in the voices of women by women. And the greatest part is that women were prominent in all key areas of the production of the series, so from cinematography to recording assistance. So many days during shootings, there was an all-women set, and their goal in the series is not only to illustrate the dangers and lack of regulation in the self-help industry, but to place the narrative in the hands of the women affected and help them turn their truth into activism. They knew that working on the story would require a deft amount of sensitivity to create an environment that was safe and comfortable for the subjects to unburden themselves. For example, a key element of filming was training the crew on how to handle the trauma victims that they would be interviewing. This is a superb series, and it really gives voices to those victims. And I'm telling you, it is a must watch. It is a must watch. And if you've watched The Vow on HBO, or if you have not, you can watch both of these series and get so much out of it. And I think it's important to watch stories like this because we all know somebody who is a seeker, and they could very easily go down a rabbit hole like these other women. Think of the people that are suggesting to you a self-help book now. They're someone that's ripe for targeting, just like these women. My guests in this episode are the filmmakers Cecilia Peck and Inbal Lesner, and I also have a former NXIVM member, Kelly Thiel. Kelly is a speaker, an author, activist, and featured in Seduced, and she was a member of NXIVM from 2016 to 2018. I'm really proud of this series, of what they're doing to help other people who are in similar situations, and again, giving voice to victims. And I'm honored to have the opportunity in this episode to interview them. So here we go. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much.
Tell me about how this project was developed.
Well, it started because, and I'm Cecilia speaking, I was actually targeted unsuccessfully for recruitment by NXIVM by a former colleague, and she in 2014-15 started sending me a very persistent series of emails inviting me to a women's group and telling me it was the best thing she'd ever done and it would change my life, and eventually that her friend Allison Mack wanted to meet me. And I didn't reply. I wasn't sure what it was and was busy and just it didn't fit into anything I wanted to do at the time, but she didn't stop. I finally had to tell her to, you know, I just said, whatever that is, I'm happy for you, but I'm not interested. And then in 2017, she had emailed and said, I'm so sorry. I was in a cult and I didn't realize it. And I was being forced to recruit you. So that's how I found out about Nexium. We sat down and she told me about the whole experience and ended up introducing us to some of the women who are part of Seduced.
What was it about you, did she explain, was the reason that you were targeted?
She never explained that. I mean, I later understood that people were targeted for a variety of reasons, and probably what they would have been looking for in someone like me is access to a social network, or, I mean, they targeted a lot of people who are from prominent families. My father was an actor. I grew up in Los Angeles. I assume they wanted to connect to my social or professional circles, but they also targeted people who had computer skills, who had design skills, who were organized. The cult found and went after anybody who could help them build their organization.
And so what was the timeline? So she comes to you in late 2017. How soon after did you start the project? And then how soon after into the project were you able to meet up with India Oxenberg?
Yes. So we started working, developing, researching at the end of 2018. And started working with STARS in 2019, and then ended up, you know, in the beginning, I think we were really interested in exploring coercion of women in high control groups. And Nexium was just the lens through which we examined that, and it was one case study. But we really wanted to look at these dynamics and how could an organization that advertised feminism, female empowerment, used all these key phrases to lure women in for self-improvement, for bettering themselves, really ends up being sort of a bait and switch tactic to subjugate them and to brainwash them into, you know, hating themselves, hating their own femininity or, you know, womanhood. So I think we were looking, we have one survivor in particular, Naomi, who was born into one cult and was sexually traumatized there as a child, and then found herself searching for a community later in life and got involved with Nexium. And so I think once we started covering the trial in Brooklyn, Keith Raniere trial, and then definitely once India joined us in the fall of 2019, then the focus or the spine of the story became more about Nexium.
How difficult was it to get the women to come forward? You guys have a great track record of working on stories of women, women's empowerment. You're very familiar with the complexities of working with trauma survivors. How difficult was it for them to come forward, to open up, and to ultimately agree to tell their stories?
I think once the New York Times story was published and Nexium was identified with the use of the term sex cult in the media, it made it very hard for anybody to speak up because of the shame that would be associated with being part of something like that. Most women didn't experience sexual abuse, and that's certainly not the type of organization they joined. So I think it was hard for anybody to decide to go public about this experience, but the women who did, from Kelly to Naomi, Tabby, Ashley, Deb, and India, all understood that it was important to show that they, as normal women, could be anybody's friend, daughter, wife, could be vulnerable to something like this, and to talk about what the red flags are in order to help other young women hopefully recognize what these groups look like and these very insidious tactics they use, and be able to help other people and prevent them from joining. So yeah, I think it was very hard, and it's embarrassing, and it takes a lot of courage, but pretty much everyone we worked with, including, you know, on our crews and our editors, had seen our previous film, Brave Miss World, and understood that we had a sensitivity toward victims of trauma, and that our mission really is to tell the stories of people who turn that kind of trauma into activism and into, hopefully, education.
Did any of the women that participated get a lot of pushback from members that had yet to leave the organization? And did that complicate the process of filming at all?
I mean, we only know about it secondhand, so you should probably ask Kelly when you talk to her. But yes, it was true for Kelly. It was true for others who were still in touch through secret Facebook groups and WhatsApp groups, who were still in touch with both former members and current members, that pressured them to stay silent, to pressure them that, you know, maybe they don't know enough because they were not in the center core of the organization in Albany. Maybe they were just Jeunesse, you know, the women subgroup members in LA. And so they should be quiet because they're not really an authority to speak about NXIVM. But, you know, what we found out is that there was trauma on all levels. It was really a sort of a collateral damage on all different, you know, both in the center of the organization and the peripheries. So it doesn't matter if you took one class or a year-long membership or, you know, really advanced to the coaching levels and went all the way and moved to Albany, there was trauma and lingering psychological damage on all levels. And so all these stories count. There were reportedly 17,000 members that went through NXIVM. And so we felt there are 17,000 stories and they all deserve to be told.
Does the process get easier interviewing the subjects as time goes on? Is it difficult in the beginning because they're still unraveling all of the language that they've been taught through the process of the tracks?
I mean, I think our film is a linear journey following India's experience from the first time she walked through those doors up until she was, you know, a branded DOS victim. But there's another layer of her perspective that she has now, and reviewing the events that happened to her through an understanding of the brainwashing. So I think we watched her go through a journey of it becoming more and more clear of what had happened to her. And she, you know, when we met her, we said, "How are you?" And she said, "Well, you know, I'm trying to understand the difference between what happened to me and what I was indoctrinated to believe what was happening to me." So we felt like that is a very incredible journey that she could take us on if she's willing. And she really did. She just opened up her experience to try to allow us and an audience to understand her peeling back the layers of that indoctrination as she was trying to come to terms with it herself.
So that's really becomes the spine of the narrative. India and the other women give you their firsthand account of what they thought and felt at the time, while the cult experts, psychologists, sociologists, explain to you what is really going on, what are the indoctrination tactics, what is the manipulation at play here. And so this tension, I think, is what drives the narrative and helps the viewers put both relate to the main characters, but also put what they're seeing in context.
And there's one more layer, which is the mother and daughter story, you know, of how that of predatory alienation, how Nexium almost managed to completely sever the bond between Catherine and India, and how they find their way back to each other.
I wondered, in terms of Catherine's story, how difficult it was for her during the course of filming to be in communication with so many former members and reconciling that they were at some point complicit in the abuse of her child. Was that something that was evident as you were filming?
It's our view, and I think shared by Catherine, that Keith was the villain of this story. He was the mastermind. He was the serial predator, and everyone to one degree or another was his victim. And he was able to indoctrinate members of his inner circle enough that they victimized others. And that was even true for India to some degree. But Catherine collaborated with members of that inner circle who were defecting from Nexium in order to bring the organization down. She couldn't have done it on her own. She used her public profile to attract the attention of the media, but it was really a group effort and a collaboration.
Did you get defectors all the time contacting you as you continued through the filming process?
Well, I think we can say that we were in touch with a lot more people who wouldn't come on camera than those who have. So some of them became kind of behind the scenes consultants or helped us gain better understanding and context of the story. But those who did come forward, it was difficult for them because of the pressure from former members, both who were no longer loyal to Keith and those who are. And we realized early on that we needed to give them a lot of support beyond what we can as sensitive filmmakers. And we set up a fund to provide therapy services for them before, during, and after filming. And so we partnered with FACT, Families Against Cultic Teachings, which is a charity organization that fights cults. And we established a fund so that they feel supported and safe in sharing their stories and, you know, telling things that could be re-triggering.
How easy was it to get access to some of the footage? You say in the beginning of the film each week or the series that we are going to be privy to footage that has never been seen. How hard was it to get access to that and to use it?
A lot of the footage was formerly available online. It's now been taken down, but we were able to capture a certain amount of it from different sites, and we had different sources who came forward and helped. The FBI had access to this footage, so we were able to accumulate enough footage that we needed to tell the story and, you know, provide one of the layers along with our firsthand accounts. And our series is really told through the first person experiences of the victims of this cult.
What was the biggest challenge filming a series like this?
I think it was getting people to feel safe and comfortable enough to come on camera and feel that they would be protected and that their stories wouldn't be distorted. That takes a lot of trust.
I think another challenge was that in the beginning, STARS, the network we partnered with, thought we could get this, you know, filmed and edited and done in less than a year. And it was going to be pretty straightforward. But the reality is, once we sat in the courtroom and heard things that came out and were revealed for the first time, and then when India joined us, we really, the more we dug, the more we found out, and the more complex and layered the story became, and the more we felt it needed time and care and nuance to tell it. And so we're really grateful that they stuck with it and that they let us see it through and tell it the way we felt it should be told. So, you know, we went many months over when the show should have been repped and done, and just until we felt we had a story that felt complete.
How do you as filmmakers compartmentalize or kind of unwind from such such complex information and material? I mean, the stories of the survivors, to just read through the testimonies, it has to weigh on you so heavily. How did you navigate filming a series of this importance and still separate yourself and have, you know, your own full life?
Thank you for asking the question, because I do think that's a subject that's not talked about enough, is the mental health of documentary filmmakers and what it takes of people working in this field to tell these stories and work in this day after day. And the same therapy services we offered our subjects, we actually realized we need to make them available for our crew, for our editing crew. We had people who logged this material and went through lectures of Keith or Nancy that felt like something in their brain was not quite the same, and they needed to go on a walk or clear their head. Or we started having weekly meetings where we would kind of try to process this as a group, as a team, and really discuss.
For both of you, tell me the most poignant moment for you. Maybe the most proud moment where you felt like this is it. This is the reason that this is project needed to be made, and I'm honoring these women in the best way, and this sort of encapsulates it.
I guess for me, one of my favorite moments in the series, and because it touches on this predatory alienation in the ability of a group like this to separate you from your loved ones and your family and your friends and anyone who can remind you of your pre-cult persona. And NXIVM was so successful at it. And this doesn't just happen in high control groups. It can happen in a one-on-one cult-like relationship where you can suddenly be separated from your friends and family by somebody who wants to control you. But, you know, Indy and her mother didn't speak for nearly a year in the worst of it, when the cult had really gotten their hooks into India. And it was very hard for her to recognize that how NXIVM and its upper leadership had convinced her that her mom didn't have her best interest at heart. And there's a moment in the final episode when she speaks to a lawyer, and it's like a moment of recognition that what her mother was doing, even though at the time it felt like her mother wanted to hurt her, was actually trying to save her. So there are moments like that for me that resonate emotionally, that I think are about a bigger picture of what can happen when you're under the control of a master predator. And that's one of my favorites, when India kind of recognizes my mom, really what she wanted to do was help me.
Mm-hmm. She loved me. Yes. What about for you, Inbal?
So many. I mean, there were so many serendipitous moments on set where we were like, okay, we're freezing, or we're going really 24/7, no sleep, but we feel like we're onto something and doing the right thing. I mean, the verdict definitely was one of those where it was so heightened emotion for everybody. But one of the scenes I think that, you know, wasn't easy and really paid off is when India goes back to the townhouse where Daniela was imprisoned for 2 years. And this is years before she moved to Albany, but she has this memory of having been in the house because she was friends with the other members of the family. And she thinks about what it was like to be imprisoned in the room without a lock. And I think she makes the connection in real time to how she was a prisoner in Albany, There was no lock on the door. You know, nobody was forcing her or chaining her to a bedroom. But for India, like Daniela, there were these invisible chains, which were all psychological. And you see on the screen the stark parallels, the crazy parallels between Daniela's journals that were court exhibits, that were trial exhibits, and India's journals from the time where, from the time she was in Albany, all spinning in her head, like something was terribly wrong with you and you had to keep working at improving yourself, and they're just keep breaking you down and breaking you down. And I think she realized that they had a very similar journey, that they have the very similar trauma. And I think that really clicks when you see that scene. So I'm very proud of that.
And I can't wait to see what else you guys do, because this has just been so well done. So number one, I wanted to say thank you. People can catch it on demand or anywhere where you watch your favorite Starz shows. But you guys also have a great website, if you could tell everybody about that.
Well, the website really grew out of the desire for these women to become advocates for other girls. And it's called seduceddocumentary.com. It was built by two of the former members who appear in our series, Naomi and Tabby. They both have web design and coding skills, and they created this incredible resource, which includes a questionnaire, how do you know if you're in a cult, and information on all the books, all the information from Dr. Yanya Lalit, Stephen Hassan, Rick Ross, Rachel Bernstein. There's access to all of those experts. You can reach out directly to all of the women who appear in Seduced, and it's there for anybody who needs help leaving or who may have left and is still experiencing trauma. One of our friends, Hoyt Richards, a former cult member, says, if you think it's hard to be in a cult, you have no idea that the hardest part is coming out of one. So we wanted to, you know, help our incredible, you know, brave survivors create this resource. And, you know, I think we're also really excited about episode 4 in our series, because episode 3 is very hard to take. It goes into the worst abuses and crimes of NXIVM. But in episode 4, you're left with a belief that it's possible to recover and you can heal, and it's full of hope, and the stories of these women turning their trauma into being able to speak out and help other women.
It's fantastic. And then is there anywhere that they can follow you, the both of you and your work?
Well, we also, there's in this new website, seducedocumentary.com, there's also a filmmaker's page with information about us. We also run another website together, bravemissworld.com, which is the number one website in the world as a global resource for rape survivors who are seeking a forum to tell their stories and resources. So we're reachable through those two sites.
Thank you so much for your time, and really well, well done.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you.
Kelly, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
I'm really excited to talk to you because I feel like I've been a NXIVM scholar for a couple years now. I've been voraciously reading everything that has to do with the cult, watched everything. I think Seduced has done an extraordinary job in really showing the grittier part of the story, kind of spelling out the system of DOS, but also giving people a window into how so many educated, thoughtful, kind people were bamboozled by this really gross guy, Keith Raniere. So I was hoping that you could kind of give us some insight into how you fell into the organization and what your experience was like. So maybe if you could go back to the beginning and tell us a little bit about yourself and how you found out about NXIVM.
Okay, well, I have always been a seeker as long as I can remember. And prior to being introduced to NXIVM, I had gone to the Philippines. I'd worked with a psychic surgeon. I had met the Dalai Lama. I had gone to homeopathic school, all looking for ways to help myself and others. And I got to a point in 2016 where all of my searching and all of my reading and all of my classes just didn't seem to be fulfilling me. And I couldn't figure out what was wrong because I had this really great life. I had a great husband and kids. I went to college. I did all the right things, but I still was feeling empty. And in 2016, a friend of mine mentioned something about some classes she was taking, and they were human potential classes that were just, they had changed her life and her son's life. And I kind of blew it off as something I really wasn't interested in because I believed I had done everything. And then one day I was in the shower and I just, my life just felt like it was imploding. I was just so unhappy and in so much pain that I thought, what was she talking about? So I gave her a call. And she said, oh, by the way, come on over to my house on Sunday. And there's a guy there by the name of Mark Elliott who's going to be talking about these classes. Come on over. So I went over to her house and he gave basically an introduction to the classes. And it sounded really great because it sounded like a way to increase my human potential, a way to sort of reach my goals. I was a little bit hesitant because one of the first things that he said was, there's some bad press out there about us, but go ahead and read it anyway. And you'll see that it's just bad press. They're trying to shut us down because we're such an amazing organization. So I went ahead and jumped in, took the classes, and I found them to be quite amazing. So I took the classes up in Los Angeles at someone's home. And the first thing I thought was, it's kind of weird that we're doing this in a home and not like a regular office or somewhere like that. So the first 5 days I took and I just fell in love with them. I started to feel after my first exploration of meaning, the first EM, I started to feel like my life was going to be, I was going to be able to change my life for the better. I found a community of people that were all like-minded. They all had a mission to make the world a better place. And so I felt like I had found my people in a way. So I was super excited.
Did you get a feeling that they had researched you at all before you came? Or did that come later?
That came later, for sure. At the time, no. I mean, I really went into this fairly, I wouldn't say blindly, but I went into it very open-minded because, like I said, I had done so many different things, so many different modalities trying to help myself and others that this just seemed like another one. And I was just ready to explore it. So I never felt that intent at the time.
How much did it cost for that first 5-day series?
The first 5-day series was about $5,000.
And then over the course of the 2 years that you were involved with NXIVM, how much do you think that you had spent?
I probably spent personally around $25,000 to $30,000. That's about $30,000 altogether.
Would you say that that's the average that other people spend, or it kind of depends on if they are still working a job? Is it possible to have a real, full-time job and also do this?
Well, most of the people, I'd say average, yes. I think if you were involved in the community, if you just took the classes, the first 16 day or even just the 5 days and left the community, just took the classes and went about your life, that was kind of the end of it. But if you got involved, like I did as a coach, it was very easy to spend that kind of money over time because they were always telling you, this is the next class you need to take to reach your human potential. So I'd say, yeah, that's about average.
And how many people did it seem wanted to go from just taking courses to becoming a coach? Was that commonplace for people to become so consumed by the coursework that they wanted to become a coach?
I'd say probably, let's say out of a class of 20 people going through a program, you would probably get 2 or 3 to agree to become a coach. Now, the proctors who were higher than coaches and even the coaches themselves were always looking for people with that type of mindset who would want to become a coach. So I was definitely targeted in that way.
And of the people that were in that group of 20, was there a variety of industries that people came from? Or did you find that beyond just the seekers, people that were like self-help junkies, that there was a typical person, like somebody who was in education, somebody who was in acting? I mean, obviously you're in Southern California, so the industry here is more creative. What was your experience?
So my experience in my first 16 day, of course, was in LA. So I was surrounded by models and actors, people in the movie industry, because those are the people that were being recruited and enrolled in that area. But there are also people who own businesses and most people were very successful, because you have to remember that in order to pay for these classes, you had to have some amount of success in your life somewhere. So everybody around me was educated, successful, or in the arts, in those types of industries.
So you join, you begin enrolling others in Orange County. You're actually quite good at it. You're bringing a bunch of people in, and then they encourage mm-hmm. you to be a coach. And you mentioned that you took a test in order to be a coach that made no sense. There were no real answers.
Correct.
I'd never heard that before.
Correct.
Tell me a little bit about that test.
So this test went in levels. So the very first test you would take was when you were trying to become a coach. And there were questions on there. They redefined many definitions. For example, they redefined good and bad. And so you had to be able to recite that definition and explain that definition. And it's very confusing because, for example, in Nixium, good meant that you were building value and bad was the destruction of value. And you'd have to try to explain how that works in real life. And so many of the questions didn't make any sense whatsoever. And there was no definite answer. And we were told that. So we were evaluated on whether or not we passed the test. And I did not ever pass any of these tests. We were evaluated by the person reading the test, deciding whether or not, basically, if we were indoctrinated enough.
Oh my gosh.
That's my understanding. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's crazy.
So they have you sign an NDA. And now that you're a coach, you're taking trips to Albany. On mm-hmm. one of these trips, they have you meet Keith. Tell me a little bit about that.
When I took my 5-day, I loved it so much that I jumped on an airplane to finish the 6 through 16 days, there was a day in between. So basically I did 1 through 5 in LA, hopped on a plane, and then the following day I started day 6 in Albany. Somewhere in there, in the beginning of like maybe day 8 or 9, Mark Elliott said to me, I really want you to meet Keith. Now, he knew that I was part of Young Presidents Organization, YPO. And so he really wanted to find a way, I think, to get into speaking with that organization and recruiting people.
Of course.
That was a red flag for me. That was my first red flag, honestly, was when he was pushing so hard for me to meet Keith. Now, I was exhausted after, 12-hour day, 14-hour day classes. I'm a girl who needs her sleep. So I was tired. I wanted to go back to my hotel. And Mark said, no, you can't. You have to go and meet Keith at volleyball at like 11 o'clock at night. And I said, oh my God, no. And so he said, you can't say no. And I said, well, I'm not going to do it tonight. So another person came in, Jim Del Negro, and he said, you can't say no to this. Keith doesn't want to meet just anybody. I mean, this is really special. I mean, Kelly, you can't turn this down. You just can't. So I felt sort of like obligated to go. And I told Mark, I said, listen, I will go for 15 minutes. And after 15 minutes, you need to drive me back to my hotel. I didn't have a car. And so he said, okay, done. So we went and I met Keith at volleyball, and he was there waiting sort of on the side of the volleyball court when I walked in. And he came up to me and he said, are you a hugger? Oof. And I'm like, what? I don't know, I guess. And so then he just gives me this big hug. And I was kind of freaked out. I knew something was wrong. Why does this guy want to meet me? He's kind of creepy. He's wearing volleyball gear. It's 11 o'clock at night. What the hell am I doing? So that was my experience meeting Keith.
And all the people around him are like, this is a big deal. Even in the volleyball court, they're like, oh my God, it's Vanguard. And are these women just like staring at him? They're hanging on every word.
They're all dressed in shorts and cute clothes, and they're all kind of just hanging around him. And they're like, oh, who is she? Like, why does he want to meet her? And all of them coming up to me, do you know how amazing it is you got to meet Keith so early on in this? You've only been here 7 days or something like that. Wow, this is so amazing. Are you just so impressed? And didn't occur to me that this was a cult, but it did occur to me that it was a very unusual situation. And honestly, coming from California and being in Albany, I thought, well, maybe it's just something they do here. There's nothing to do in Albany. Right. No offense to anyone who lives there, but I mean, it's very desolate there. There's just nothing there. So I thought, okay, maybe this is just the way they live. So I tried not to judge it, and I was exhausted. So I didn't really think too much about it after that.
How many of the people that are in the organization live in Albany? Like, are they encouraging people to move there? Who's living there? Just the high level coaches, proctors?
Most all of the high level coaches and proctors either live full time in Albany or had an apartment and live part time in Albany. Many people, especially after they started recruiting for DOS or the VAL, more people started moving to Albany. And I'd say almost all of the integral people in the organization lives in Albany, including people from Mexico as well. So there's a lot of people who had second homes in Albany who lived in Mexico City.
Were you ever invited to Nancy's home or Allison's home?
Nancy's home, yes, a few times. Allison's home, no.
And did Keith have a home that people visited, or did he keep his home really private?
He kept his home very private, except for the people that were in his very inner circle.
So as you're going through the program, the three things that they had you work on were lack of measurability and accountability, entitlement mm-hmm. issues, and lack of compassion. Were those things that they came up with, or?
The entitlement part, definitely. Claire Bronfman was the person who pointed that out from the very beginning, which is so ironic, if you know who Claire Bronfman is. Yeah. And I know you do. I mean, Seagram's Harris. I mean, she sat down in a group with me very early on and just basically told me, you're entitled, just admit it. And so when someone like that says that to you, I mean, I started to think, well, maybe that's my problem. You know, maybe I am entitled. I mean, I have a very nice life. I get to do a lot of things. I travel. I'm very fortunate. So I thought, well, maybe entitlement is my problem. So I started to believe it. And then as far as the compassion goes, I think that's just sort of a throwaway for everyone. We're all trying to be more compassionate. So that one I easily bought too. And so I think over time, when those things are repeated to you and people start to see you in the organization as that, like that's her inner deficiency. That's her problem. She's entitled. That's her problem. She lacks compassion. It was not something I came up with myself, but something that I sort of bought after being told multiple times because I was looking for an answer. I was trying to figure out what was wrong with me.
Did you know a lot about other people and what they were working on? So through these courses, were people revealing so much about themselves? Like, did you know an enormous amount about each person to the point where you ever felt like, I think I'm privy to things that maybe I shouldn't be?
Well, that's a good question. In the group work that we did, many people, including myself, would become very comfortable talking about our personal things. We trusted the other coaches. We trusted the proctors with our most intimate things because those are the things that we were working on and trying to get past. So many people would reveal that they had been raped or abused or sexually molested. And it was a very sacred place to hear these things. And we tried to keep it very sacred. But there were many times where I felt, okay, I'm out of my league here. We're out of our league. This person needs real help. They need a therapist. And I mentioned this many times to people. And so what I would do in that case was move them up to someone who I believed at the time could handle something like this, which would be Nancy.
Did you ever see any correlation between the people that came forward with stories like that, previous sexual assault, who were targeted to be members of DOS?
Not that I can recall. Although it wouldn't surprise me, but I'm trying to think. I don't recall anybody specifically in DOS that had, yes, actually, that's not true. Yes, I there were a few who had had, especially from Mexico, who had been involved in kidnappings, or their family had been kidnapped, things like that.
So how were you approached to be in DOS? You'd mentioned that a member named Lisa spoke to you about DOS in the beginning. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yes, yeah, so I changed the name here, but the person that we'll call Lisa, she was a friend of mine. We were close in the organization, and she was of higher rank than myself. And she approached me after an intensive that I was coaching at dinner, and she said, I just want to talk to you about something that I think you might be interested in. And I'm part of a women's group that is outside of NXIVM. So there's no one in ESP or NXIVM that is involved in this group. And we're working on accountability and measurability. And I really think this would help you. And she said, I can't really tell you much more about this, but if you want to know more, I need for you to give me some kind of collateral. And she said, the collateral is going to be used just to keep what we're talking about confidential. So I was like, okay, like what are you talking about, collateral? And she said, well, we can come up with something that, you know, like maybe you talk about your business, or you talk about someone that you know and don't have anything that you can tell me, then we can make something up. And we'll record it, or we'll videotape it, but we'll get to that later. But first, we just need to figure out if this is something you want to do. And I was sitting at dinner, and I was thinking, oh my God, I kind of want to know what she's talking about, because I admire her, but this seems kind of weird to give collateral. So I said, well, I need to think about this. So we went our separate ways, and over the course of probably 3 weeks or so, she continued to meet with me or call me and keep asking me, had I made up my mind yet? And I started avoiding her phone calls, because I was just, at this point now in the game, I was completely conflicted, because I knew that I wanted to say yes to this, because I didn't want to disappoint her. I didn't want to have it affect anything I was doing in ESP and NXIVM as far as the coaching stripe path. But my body and my intuition and everything about me was in turmoil and wanted to say no and run. So I was in, it was a huge conflict for me at that time.
And then also at the same time, you're asking Mark Elliott about rumors. At one point you said you asked, does Keith have a harem? And his response, which seems to mirror a lot of the responses internally, was, where is your data? So if at any point someone in the organization stepped forward and asked questions, the response is, you have to give me data that backs that up. Well, how do you give data on rumors? So because of that, you sort of ignored a lot of the rumors. And you're also being told that people that don't kind of agree with the group's philosophy are suppressive, which is a borrowed term from the Church of Scientology. So what were the other ways that they were suppressing you from getting information quicker about what was going on within the organization?
Well, the main way that this was done was when I would ask a question about what was going on, it would immediately be turned back around to me to, first of all, do you have data? And second of all, why do you need to know? What is so important over here, meaning the question that I was asking, versus what's going on inside here? Why don't you work on yourself? What is it in you? What deficiency do you have that you need to know what somebody's doing in their private life, or what's going on behind closed doors over there? So it's always it was always sent back to me. It was always redirected back to me and my deficiencies.
What began to trouble you the most?
What began to trouble me the most was Jeunesse. I took the Jeunesse tracks, which were 8-day tracks. I took 3 of them in Mexico City. And when I really started questioning things was, I grew up with a feminist mother. So I grew up wearing as a small child an ERA bracelet, Equal Rights Amendment bracelet. And my mother was always pushing for anything in that area. And I found myself almost going back to like 1950s values in my head, you know, that women should not speak up and that we're entitled princesses living in a bubble and all of these things that went totally against who I was and how I grew up. So that was kind of my first sort of feeling. And then the other thing that was happening was that the men in the organization around after being in for about a year or so started to be very controlling of me. They started to suppress me and start to control me. And I was starting to feel it. And again, I grew up, nobody controlled me, you know, nobody's going to tell me what to do. You're not the boss of me. And so I found myself getting into arguments with a lot of the men in the organization and they were calling me defiant. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, yeah, I guess I am being defiant, but I was pushing back. So those two things in combination were really starting to kind of wear away at me.
How much what did it cost to take a Jeunesse track?
I think that I'm trying to remember the Jeunesse tracks were like $15,000.
Oh my God.
For
8 days?
Tracks.
Oh, for three tracks.
Yeah. So for you are three tracks of 8 days. So 24 days in total, broken up into three different tracks at three different times and about 5,000 or 6,000 each.
And do people take those tracks right after one another or do they break them apart, you know, a couple week break?
Well, for example, I took mine in 2016, I took it in November and then February of 2017 and then May of 2017. So right around the time DOS broke, I was in Mexico taking the last Jeunesse track that I took.
And all of the tracks were held in Mexico?
Not all of them. Some of the tracks were held in Albany, but I think because the majority of the people taking the tracks at the time I did were from Mexico. So we just all went to Mexico to take them.
And at which track included the part with the Society of Protectors, where they're flipping the script on you and making people do plank or women do planks? Which track is that in the last one?
I only took the first three tracks. I believe that track is further on, like six or seven.
Okay.
But SOP and SOP Complete. So SOP was the men's organization and SOP brought the women in. SOP Complete is where they started using penance and things like planks and punishment and readiness calls and things like that.
What was your experience with the others that are featured so heavily in The Vow? And then, of course, Seduce. So how well did you know Mark and Sarah? Were they actively in Albany all the time? Were they familiar to other members of NXIVM?
I believe they were pretty much familiar to anyone in the community. Bonnie Peace, Mark Vicente's wife, was my coach before she left. And I had a pretty good relationship with them all. I didn't know Sarah Edmondson that well. Mark was the head of the center in Los Angeles, so I knew him. And of course, Bonnie was my coach, so I knew her. But I think everybody pretty much knew who they were within the organization. And Mark was on the board. So,
did you go to V Week? People want to know if you had the chance to go to a V Week.
Yes, I did go to V Week in 2016.
And what was that experience like?
Well, it was actually a lot of fun. We had these group classes that you could take. So you could learn how to sing, which I took that one, or you could learn how to drum. I also took that one. And we would meet throughout V-Week, V-Week was like 10 days altogether, and we would meet throughout the week practicing with the people who were taking these classes, and then we would perform at the end of V-Week. We performed for Keith's birthday, and it was a lot of fun.
Were you at any point like, oh, do we have to celebrate with another cake, or is this like another day of celebration? Like, it's almost like a toddler, like, we get it, it's your birthday.
Well, I guess in the beginning, it was just a weekend event, which is still a lot, and then extended out to all of these days. And the one thing, I'll never forget this. The first night I was there, they had this, every night, everybody would meet in the auditorium. And sometimes Keith would speak, sometimes he wouldn't. And they were doing all the promotions. And I skipped that particular evening. I was tired, so I skipped it. And I was told by a bunch of people, you know, never skip that one again. This is the best one where everybody gets promoted and we can give tribute to everybody. And tribute is the most important thing. We must give tribute. We must give tribute to everyone, including Keith. And so I think that idea of tribute was just ran through V Week. So, I mean, having a cake for Keith every day would have been completely normal for a lot of people. They would have loved it. I know it sounds crazy, but.
What about Allison performing? Because in the Stars documentary, they show, and I've seen it several times online, where she's singing to him and clearly she's in love with him. But she's honestly like not that good of a singer and very melodramatic. Were you guys as uncomfortable as we were watching that? Or are you just like totally buying it hook, line, and sinker?
I think there were probably some people that were buying it hook, line, and sinker because everybody was in this mode of we're all together, kumbaya, everything's okay, failure's okay, you're okay, we love everybody as is. And so seeing her do that, I remember watching it and going, that's a little, but at the same time, I was kind of, everyone around me is like, oh, you know, look at that. And then I'm thinking to myself, well, you know, I guess if I were up there singing and I didn't sound so great, I would hope that everyone around me wouldn't be judging me. And so there was this feeling of everybody, there's no judgment, no criticism. You can be who you are. So it's very freeing, actually.
So at what point did you understand that there were women sleeping with Keith?
Not until I actually heard from them, like not until I actually heard their story. So it would have been after, I mean, I'd heard the rumors and I saw the way he was kissing everyone and, you know, he would kiss everyone on the lips when he saw them. So, and everyone was kissing everyone on the lips, honestly. Many people kissed each other on the lips. So it wasn't just Keith. And I think I started to realize there was something going on around the time that DOS broke open, you know, when the Frank report came forward with that.
Yeah, because you read a report and then you get a call from Canada from a member that was encouraging you to read the Frank report and told you that something was going on. What was the message that she gave you?
So I was I received a call from someone in Canada and she said, I need to talk to you. And I need to tell you about something. I said, okay. And she said, I'm sending you a link to the Frank report. And I need you to erase it immediately and not tell anyone that you got it from me. And I said, okay. So I hung up the phone, looked at the link, started reading this particular article in the Frank report. And I was reading it and it didn't make any sense to me. I was like, okay, they're talking about these women. And then I saw the word collateral. And all of a sudden, a light bulb went off. Yeah. And I thought, collateral, is that what she was talking about? Is that what Lisa was talking about?
Yeah.
So I called her immediately and I said, is this what you were talking about? And she said, yes, it's what I was talking about. So for her, she didn't know everything that was going on. She didn't know the whole big picture. So when she realized what was going on, she's like, okay, yeah, that's what I was doing. Now, I hung up the phone with her. I called back the woman who called me from Canada, and she said, you've got to get out. You've got to get out. And I was sitting, I'll never forget this moment. I was sitting in a chair, and I had this wave come over me. It was very strange. It was like this door, this portal opened up, and all I could see and hear and feel was evil, and it was Keith.
Wow.
And it was the most amazing, weird experience I've ever had. And then the door just shut. And then I thought, oh my God, what was that? This feeling of evil was it just permeated my body. And I thought to myself, that can't be real. Keith can't be evil. There's no way he can be evil. He's created this curriculum that's helping people. We're all, you know, working on ourselves. We have this mission to help, you know, make the world a better place. Keith can't be evil. And so that's when I started, the cracking started at that point for me.
Also, you have a successful husband. You are around a lot of successful people. When you would talk about the organization, and you mentioned, well, he's one of the most smartest men in the world, most ethical man, conferred with the Dalai Lama. He only sleeps 4 hours a night. Did anybody outside say, this just doesn't sound right?
Yes. So many of my close friends were questioning me, but I was they didn't want to lose me as a friend. So they were very gentle with me. I have to, looking back, I see that. And in conversations that we've had since. So I could tell in a very, very quickly in a conversation, if somebody was going along with what I was saying or not. And if I felt any pushback at all, I would either end the conversation or move on to something else. So I was very, very good at being either the Orange County girl or the cult girl. So there were two of me kind of running around inside. So I could go to an event, let's say maybe a Young President's Organization event, or I could go to a fundraiser and I could be the Orange County girl and not talk about the cult, not behave in any interesting different ways. Or I could be very much involved with NXIVM and enrolling people. So it would just kind of depend on my audience and depend on where I was. I was like a chameleon.
What do you think about Allison now that all this information has come forward? Could you see the signs there that she was much more manipulative than people had thought? I mean, you had spent a lot of time with Allison when you did the Jeunesse tracks, and you're familiar with mm-hmm. the women of Jeunesse. Is all of this surprising to you, or is it like puzzle pieces clicking together?
Well, there's a lot of puzzle pieces definitely clicking together. I remember on the third Jeunesse track in Mexico, this is around May of 2017. So this is when they're recruiting like crazy for DOS. Like there was this huge push on it, apparently. And she was coming up to me in the classes and saying things like, you know, you're smoking hot and you know you are, right? And I was like, what? You know, she's like 15 or 20 years younger than me. And so she would come up and she'd sort of stand next to me and sort of put her arms around me and sort of bump up against me. And like, this is kind of strange behavior. And so she started to want to go out to lunch and things like that. So we're going to have lunch one day. And she said, oh, I have to go now. Keith's calling me. And I have this play that I want to do in San Diego, but I have to ask him first if I can do it. And I thought, well, that's just weird. I think you should just do the play. She goes, no, I have to ask Keith. So she ran, made a phone call to Keith, came back and said, Keith said I could do it. I'm going to go. I said, I think that's a good call. And at that point, I started thinking there's something seriously wrong with her. Not only was she had lost a ton of weight, but she was behaving in ways that seemed not only erratic, but almost like, I don't even know the word for it. It was just erratic and not in her body. So I don't, it's hard for me to make a judgment on that because on whether or not where her intent was. I mean, it looks like from everything we've seen, you know, she was pretty, very harsh on people, obviously, but I also know what it feels like to be indoctrinated and brainwashed. And you do start to blur the line between right and wrong. Mm-hmm. It's very easy to do. And I think that happened to her. Now, I'm not saying that she doesn't deserve what's coming to her. I don't even know what that's going to be. She hasn't been sentenced yet. Mm-hmm. But as a human being to another human being, having experienced some of the things that she's experienced, it's really hard for me to know where the line between good and bad is and right and wrong for her and what she did.
Did they let you go easily? Was it hard for you to cut the cord?
No, it wasn't. I had a lot of people calling me. Even when I started the documentary, I had a lot of people calling me and telling me to just shut the F up and keep my head down.
Wow.
And don't do the documentary. I had people calling me when I first left, trying to talk me back into it. I mean, at length for hours and hours, constantly.
Have those people tried to stay in contact with you? Have most of those people left or are some of those people still in the organization?
They're all still in the organization. Most of them are in the organization. And it's heartbreaking because I care about these people. I still do. I'm still holding space for them to maybe someday see the light, but they are mostly still in part of the NXIVM 5 that are trying to help Keith.
How many people do you think are still in?
Well, from what I can see, about 56 people wrote letters for Keith. On behalf of Keith before his sentencing. So at least we know 56. I'm guessing Mexico, there's quite a few. I'm not certain, but I know there's some for sure.
And do you have any insight into the status of Nancy Salzman? I don't know how much communication she's allowed to have with anyone, but do you get a sense that she may have realized the error of her ways, or do you think that she is still a true NXIVM believer?
Yeah, it's so hard to tell. I go back and forth on that all the time. Nancy and I, so Nancy is not allowed to speak to anybody that was on the coaches list of NXIVM. And I think there were, Frank Report put that list up. I was on that list at the time. So she's not allowed to have any communication with anyone. So I have not spoken to her in over 2 years. So I do not know where she stands other than what she took responsibility for when she was did her plea bargain. But she still believes that there is something good in all of this. So that tells me that she might still be conflicted. I don't know.
Is it hard for you to watch the series playback, The Vow and Seduced? Is it hard for you to kind of listen to everybody else's story? Or have you kind of made peace with it? Like, this was just a moment of my life and to see the good that came out of it.
It's a daily question to myself. Watching The Vow and watching Seduced has been very difficult at times. I can't not watch it, you know, but I watch it and it is hard. It's very, very difficult to see because there's still some unanswered questions, and it's very hard to see the damage that has happened to people. And it's very hard to see Nancy's face because she gave me a zillion EMs. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to see her on screen because I realized, oh my gosh, that's her looking at me. That's how she used to look at me.
And then and knowing all the tactics that she used, the veiled hypnotism, all the neurolinguistic strategy tactics, it must be enormously frustrating. And you were unlike the others because they didn't tell you to lose weight because you were already, you know, a leaner person. But what is that like for you to watch the way that those women were counting their calories? You obviously saw a lot of them become quite thin. What was the reason for him wanting them to be that thin?
Well, there's a lot of theories on that, but the one that I think is probably the most truthful is that he is a pedophile and he likes women to look like little girls. And if you're 5'5" and weigh 100 pounds or something, you're going to look like have a little girl's body more or less. You're not going to have breasts. Everything's going to be diminished. So that's the only thing I can think of that makes sense to me.
What is the one thing you would love people to know as a former NXIVM member? We've, you know, seen all of the documentary episodes. We've read quite a bit. For the layperson, what do you want people to know about being a NXIVM member and the other people that were part of NXIVM?
I think what I would want people to know is that, you know, normal people can get involved in very easily in organizations like this. And these organizations are everywhere. And I think that the one thing I want people to see or actually understand and have compassion for people who get in these organizations and understand that they're not stupid people, that it can happen to anyone. And, you know, when somebody is searching or just trying to be a better person and they get involved in something like this, it's like, don't shame them. Try to understand and try to see them in yourself. Like, where could this have happened to you? And, you know, gaslighting was a huge component of NXIVM. And it's also a huge component of abusive relationships and narcissistic relationships and things like that. So I think what I'd want people to really see is start educate yourself on these types of organizations and understand that these survivors and victims of something like NXIVM really need understanding and not shame.
Where can they find more information about you?
So first, we have a website called seducedocumentary.com, And first of all, people who are cult survivors or are struggling with a cult or abusive relationship can find resources. They can find all of the survivors that were in Seduced, along with the filmmakers and people like cult deprogrammers and therapists. And I am on that website as well. I also have my own webpage called kellyteal.com. And I do speaking, and I'm also currently writing a book about my experience in NXIVM, but also, which I will point out many of the red flags about organizations like this. But it's mostly about my journey back to myself and how easy it is to be influenced by the outside world and how we can easily take on someone else's belief system. So it's really questioning those things and how, as a culture, we live in an influencer culture and how easy it is to be influenced.
Do you now feel like you see cults everywhere?
I do. I think there are different levels of cults. There's cult-like organizations. There are cult organizations. There are abusive relationships. And I do see a lot of it out there. I mean, anytime we take on someone else's belief system without critically thinking about it, or take on any belief without critically doing our homework and thinking about what it actually is, we're being influenced. Mm. So it's a very tricky thing. And I think most people don't do their homework and they don't think about things. They just say, oh, that sounds good. I'll take that in and I'll make that part of who I am.
Right.
And that's where we get in trouble.
I'm so grateful that you've come forward to tell your story. I can't thank you enough. This has been so helpful for me, and I'm sure for countless others, to kind of understand the mindset of a NXIVM member. And I'm just grateful for all of you for telling your story. And it's gonna undoubtedly will save a lot of people from heartache once they listen to this and they listen to your story. So I thank you a million times.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
I want to thank my incredible guests, Cecilia, Inbal, and Kelly, and to remind you guys to go to iTunes and leave a 5-star review. You can jump in my Facebook group, and I hope you do, to talk about this episode. And that group is called Reality Life with Kate Casey. Again, it's the Facebook group. You can find me on Twitter at Kate Casey. You can find my Instagram, which is at KKCCA. On Twitter, I tweet about shows and during shows all week long. And I'm going to be posting in my Twitter and on my Instagram the must-watch shows this week, which you've got to check out. And also, I have a Patreon page for bonus episodes. You can go to patreon.com/KKCC. Bonus episodes. You will love it. I'm grateful for your time. It's a very nutty week this week in the United States with the elections, and I'm hoping that you all gave yourself some time to just relax and to escape, and I hope that this was a part of that plan. Wishing you guys a great week, and I'm thrilled to tell you that my guests on Friday include one of the most hysterical people I have ever seen on reality television, a woman who was on Married at First Sight Australia. Her name is Inez, and there are ample clips that you can watch on YouTube, and I will also be posting, listening to her most fantastic one-liners, but also somebody who is really open about the toll of your mental health when you're on a reality show, one that absolutely that becomes a big sensation in your country. And that happened to her. So I'm really excited for you guys to hear that as well. Again, wishing you guys a great week, and I'll check back with you on Friday.
This episode is brought to you by the effortlessly scrumptious bite of Skinny Pop Popcorn. Imagine this: perfectly popped, endlessly delicious kernels, a symphony of just 3 simple ingredients: popcorn, sunflower oil, and a sprinkle of salt. No compromise, just pure snacking freedom. And hey, if you're up for a twist, dive into flavors like zesty white cheddar to sweet and salty kettle. Every bite's a delight, light and oh so tasty. Shop Skinny Pop now.